Hello, everybody. This is your telescreen has been taken over by the Foreign Press Association in New York. And we have today Masha Karp, who discusses Orwell and the Soviets. Masha wrote a fascinating book, George Orwell and Russia. I don't know if this is the right way around, but it has the iconic poster, which I don't know whether you claim credit for the discovery, about where 2 + 2 = 5 came from, which was from a Soviet propaganda poster in the 20s in connection with the 5-year plans. I must say it shows that they had a lot missing in propaganda, because the Soviet worker looking, scrutinizing his machine tools through a caliper looks extremely sinister, looks like an evil genius from a science fiction movie. But I suppose he might have been a KGB machine tool worker. Who knows? So was it the KGB then? No, it was a Cheka. Never. But nonetheless, this is the era we're discussing. So I first met Masha, I think, over 20 years ago. We're talking, it was an anniversary of 1984.
It was exactly 20 years ago, because it was Orwell's centenary. He was born in 1903, and there was a conference in 2003. I think that's where we first met in America, didn't we?
Yes, indeed. And it was a very distinguished gathering. I mean, there was Masha, there was me, but there was also Robert Conquest and Christopher Hitchin and other sort of luminaries who had made a life study of Orwell and of what he stood for. So it was, you know, there was contention, as there always will be. I mean, Christopher Hitchens was there for a start. So contention is us. Tom Cushman from Wellesley, who was the host of the occasion. And it was there I discovered, for example, and I've been reading Orwell. I think I read 1984 when I was between 8 and 9 years old. I was a precocious little brat. I probably would have denounced my father given half a chance. But Orwell, it always meant a lot for us. And then Masha was explaining some of the background, because she was the only one of us, as I remember, who had actually lived in the society that, in a sense, inspired, end quote, the world of 1984. I know that's not quite true, because Orwell's time in British bureaucracy and British academia played some part in this as well. She mentioned at the time, I think it was the difficulties of translating Animal Farm into Russian, because there's no such, the word farm in Russia doesn't mean the same as it does here. So I think it came out as kolkhoz, didn't it? A collective farm, which was, you know, not quite what Orwell was talking about. He's talking about a family of small holding in the hills down south, where, you know, the farmer, his wife, and a couple of cows and sheep, etc., etc. So it was a different context, but regardless of the farms and regardless of the rest, there was no difficulty in translating the concept, Masha reported, because people wanted to know, how did Orwell know all this? He hadn't lived there. How did he know what living in a totalitarian society is like? And at the time, I thought, you don't actually have to live in a totalitarian society with rubber truncheons to know about thought crime. I had emerged from Liverpool during a Trotskyist takeover in Liverpool, where thought crime was measured out in dollops. And, you know, apart from occasional invitations to have my leg broken, there was no there was no doubt that people motivated themselves because their inner compulsion, their inner fear, which was, I think, where Orwell really came in. He showed how people are motivated to police themselves. But Masha's book expounds on this. So you've had a mixed reception. The other part you had was, I think a lot of us hadn't quite realized that Orwell's aunt was quite such a radical, and that he had exposure to people with direct experience of Russia. And, you know, to be honest, he never really acknowledged this background, but he must have absorbed some of it. None of us are saying that Orwell was a saint, by the way. You know, all idols have feet of clay, and okay, his clay was far better quality minerals than most, but he definitely had them. So, Masha, how did all this come together for you?
Look, I read 1984 when I was much older than you were. I read it in about mid-70s in the Soviet Union, when, of course, it was a forbidden book, a banned book. And I read it in translation. So it must have been the edition published in the West and smuggled into Russia. And when I was reading it, I very palpably felt the fear that Winston Smith feels when he is reading the book in the novel. So it was still that time. I actually think that Orwell did want to show to his compatriots that the intellectual intention to build society like the Soviet one can bring very, very unpleasant consequences. And he was very obsessed by it, as people who met him in these later days, he was scared and he was obsessed that the ideas of the British socialists, of his friends, of people who were on the same side with him, that they do not fully realize what might happen if these ideas are developed to the full, as he says somewhere, that I brought these ideas or took these ideas to their logical consequences. Now, that was when I started out to explore it all. It wasn't quite clear to me how much he knew about Russia, because Ian, as you rightly said, Orwell never acknowledged his sources. It was important for him, by the way, this is, I'll say this in brackets, when he was writing his documentary books like Homage to Catalonia and even Down and Out in Paris and London, he was basing what he was saying on the facts, but he was a writer, he was an artist, and he transformed very often the things he was writing about to impress readers more. And in Homage to Catalonia, this is very obvious. But I won't go there now. And I'll try to answer the question that you asked me, how it all came about. Now, it is common to acknowledge that this, for the first time, he thought of exposing the danger of the Soviet communism in Spain. That's he himself said it, and other people said it, and all the biographers say it, and it is of course true, but it was not quite the first instance when he learned something about Russia. What he understood in Spain was something that he had not understood before, and namely that the Soviet communists controlled opinions of people in other countries, of communists primarily. But he wrote later in his intro to the in his introduction to the in his preface to the Ukrainian edition of Animal Farm that he was shocked by the way the enlightened people in democratic countries basically took on totalitarian propaganda. Before that, he wasn't, I mean, some people say, and you can come across it everywhere, that he believed in communism and then Spain came as such a horrible disappointment. I don't think so. But what he did think, he did know enough about Russia, about the Soviet Union, and I'll mention briefly why and how he knew that, but he did not think so badly about the British Communist Party. If he had been of very low opinion of them, he wouldn't have ever gone to Harry Pollitt, because
Harry Pollitt was the General Secretary of the British Communist Party.
He was the General Secretary, and because at that point it was considered that to go to fight in Spain, which Orwell desperately wanted to do at the end of 1936, one has to have some credentials from the left-wing party. And Orwell, after his experience in 1936 in Wigan, he was skeptical about communists, but still he treated them amiably. He treated them like any other party on the left. He wasn't very enthusiastic, but he thought that he might just as well go to Harry Pollitt. Harry Pollitt was more intelligent at that point. Harry Pollitt immediately understood that Orwell was not the stuff proper communists are made of. Because when Harry Pollitt said, okay, so are you going to the International Brigade? Orwell said, but let me go there, see for myself, and then I'll decide where I will go. Proper communists do not see for themselves. They just...
We should explain once again, the international brigades were almost under the direct control of the Communist Party, or the Comintern, as it
yes,
was.
Yes, yes, yes. I just was moving too fast.
We've got to watch for not on inside baseball here, or inside cricket in the case of Orwell, of course.
Yes, yeah. So basically, he still argued with me. So in the end, he went to Spain with the contingent of the Independent Labour Party. That was the party that only several years previously got detached from the proper Labour Party. And this was the party from which the Labour Party grew. Because funnily enough, the Independent Labour Party was born earlier than the Labour Party, then later became...
I knew several of the founding members.
Yeah, well, so who did you know?
There were obscure Scottish Labour Party members and Cooperative Party members who were in there with Keir Hardie. I used to read for them. That's another story.
Right, right. This is very interesting because, I'm running ahead of myself. I'll come back to it later. So basically, he went there with the ILP contingent. He discussed politics with his English friends or not necessarily friends, but people who were together there with him. And they discussed everything, and Orwell was planning to join the International Brigade already when he was in Spain. And Trotskyists, who happened to be there, like Harry Milton, the man who, the American who Orwell doesn't name in Homage to Catalonia, but we know definitely from his memoirs, from his son, from the papers he left, that was the man who tried to talk Orwell out of going to the international brigades because he was sure that Orwell would be shot immediately there, and he might have been right. But he had been a Trotskyist, and he came to fight fascism in Spain without ever, well, maybe ever, but I don't know, but without being at that point infatuated by the communists and the international brigade. Orwell, still at that point, he gave it a benefit of a doubt. He wasn't so sure. Now, let me come back and say very briefly why I think he was skeptical of Russia and of the Soviet Union. There were at least two influences. In fact, I'm sure there were more. Yes, his aunt, his favorite aunt, Aunt Nellie, was a partner of a rather remarkable man called Eugenio Lanti. So this wasn't his original name. He was born Eugen Adam. But this was a pseudonym he took, which had this contrarianism within itself. Lanti means, of course, anti-traditional theories. Now, he was a communist. He joined the Communist Party very early, the French Communist Party, because he was an Esperantist, and he thought that only with the help of Esperanto as a universal language, the proletarians of the world can unite. That would be something that would free them from the culture, from the bourgeois culture of their countries, of their respective countries. And of course, he was an idealist. And of course, he idealized the Russian Revolution. But as an idealist, he went to Russia. He was in Moscow in, I think, in 1922, if I'm not wrong. And he saw many things that really, really upset him. Apart from the poverty, he wasn't sure that the new economic policy, which at that point allowed the Soviet government to slightly revitalize the economy, because unfortunately the economy of the war communism that they introduced didn't bring much results, and people were just starving and dying. For Lanti, that already was very strange. But very soon, there came much more political, ideological conflicts with the Soviet comrades, because he couldn't understand why it was so necessary to ostracize, to boycott, and eventually to arrest and kill people of the left beliefs who did not agree with the communists. In the first place, of course, these were anarchists, and but there were other parties which the Soviet government was persecuting sometimes more cruelly than they would the rich landowners and whatnot. So when Orwell came to, when he wasn't still Orwell, he was Eric Blair, who was just over 25 in 1928 and 1929, 29, when he stayed in Paris, he heard a lot from Lanty about his horrible, horrible disappointments. And there is basically only one evidence about these two arguing and shouting at each other. And in this argument that was recorded by Lanty's friend Barnier, Orwell was seen as someone defending the Soviet system, while Lanty was criticizing it. I take it very much, very skeptically, because in anything that Orwell was writing, in everything that Orwell was writing before even he went to Spain, either in Down and Out or in The Road to Wigan Pier, we can't find a single good word about the Soviet Union. He calls Bolsheviks half gangsters, half gramophones. He talks about the stupid cult of Russia. And this influence, the impulse he received from Lanty was supported by the landlady he stayed with in London, and who also was his employer. She was a friend of Aunt Nellie's, so the role of Aunt Nellie's is treated in my book not only in chapter one, but also in chapter two, where I talk about his move to London. This woman was called, I'm always warned that the Welsh pronounce this name in a very specific way, but I will pronounce it as I was taught, and this is Mifanwy Westrow.
I'm not going to try to correct you, even though my name is Williams.
It's different. Huh? Say it again. Yeah, I couldn't.
I'm not going to try to correct you, even though my family name Williams is Welsh.
Oh, right. Okay. But anyway,
one of the issues I want to pick up here is this.
Yeah.
Orwell was very disparaging about Esperanto. And, you know, there are always questions about to what extent it influenced Newspeak. And I think you correctly suggested Basic English by Lancelot Hogben was more of an inspiration. But Esperanto must have been part of it. The whole romantic, idealistic idea of producing a language from scratch. I've actually studied Esperanto and enjoyed it, and I can see there's a place for it. But is it so important as the Soviets did, where they actually went and extirpated all the speakers, which they did in the 30s? In the 20s, they issued postage stamps in Esperanto to celebrate its part in the universalism that socialism was associated with. By the 1930s, parolon en Esperanton was enough to get you shot.
This is true, but that basically, I think this history of Esperanto in the Soviet Union, it reflects incredibly well, just precisely well, the fluctuations of the Soviet attitude towards the rest of the world. Because when there was an idea of the world revolution and the idea that workers of the world will unite, that was this fantastic support for Esperanto, and workers were encouraged to write letters in Esperanto to their friends and not to their friends, but to workers in other countries who became their friends. And these people wrote them about their own lives, and Soviet workers quite sincerely were saying how wonderful it is in the life in the Soviet Union. We hope that you will have your revolution soon and your life will be as wonderful as ours, because there was still this tremendous enthusiasm for the revolution, which was completely stamped out when the idea of the world revolution was given up by Stalin. And there is an incredible interview, which I hadn't known previously, to an American journalist who asks Stalin, I think it's already 1936 or something like this, quite late 30s, asks Stalin about the idea of the world revolution. And Stalin says, I think it's a misunderstanding. We have never wanted the world revolution. And this baffled correspondent says, misunderstanding, is it a tragic misunderstanding? And Stalin says, well, tragically comical. He just wanted to dismiss the idea, and obviously not just Esperantists, but also stamp collectors who were interested in something beyond the Soviet Union, they were also arrested and often shot because that was an unhealthy interest in other countries.
Sorry, I can't resist this. Philately got you nowhere in the Soviet Union.
Well, of course not. Yeah, no, absolutely. You were still within your borders, but there you are. The ideology has always been treated as something very serious. Now, Mifan Westrop was very anti-Soviet by the time Orwell came to live with her and to work for her and her husband, who were owners of a bookshop at a lovely place in Hampstead. Today there is a little plaque showing that Orwell lived and worked in this bookshop, but there is no more bookshop there. The number of small independent bookshops.
I was going to say there's not many bookshops anywhere, let alone.
We can admit that. But she went to the Soviet Union, and unlike very many people, these pilgrims to this cradle of the world revolution, she came back very disappointed because the man who she had hoped to see had disappeared. And everybody who she later told this story, because she lived till 1973, I think, thought that the man was arrested or shot. What I found out, and I think that was probably the greatest discovery that I made, because thanks to the internet, I found a woman who actually knew this man in Siberia, where he lived, and he survived, but it looks very much so that he was advised not to continue his relationship with a member of the Independent Labour Party, and Mifanwi was a very active member, and in the language of or the Soviet language of that time, she was a social fascist, of course, because that was the move. At that point, that was the direction that was taken. So, as I said, he was skeptical of the Soviet Union. He was shocked by the influence the Soviet communists had. He was shocked by the authority and by the power the NKVD, this is People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs, had in Spain, because Stalin was supplying weapons for the Republicans. The Soviet Union had quite a lot of influence there. And Stalin's task was not just, as many people thought, to help the Republicans against fascists, but his secret idea was to fight the people who opposed him. And the party, the United Marxist Workers Party, POUM, POUM, which is a Spanish abbreviation, the under which banner, under whose banner Orwell was fighting, was accused of being Trotskyist. Now, this is a very vague, this is a very mute question as to what extent this party was Trotskyist. True, it was headed by the man called Andras Nin, who, when he was in this Spanish communist, who, when he was in the Soviet Union, he was for some time Trotsky's secretary. But later on, he completely split away from Trotsky. And the people who were in the party, there were quite a few intellectuals, people who were trying to analyze what was going on, why some things were not quite to their liking, but they did not necessarily follow the ideas of Lev Trotsky. But this didn't matter. As the man who I argue has become a major influence on Orwell's understanding of the social, or the social analysis of or the social analysis of the forces that existed at that time in the 30s and 40s was a Vienna sociologist called Franz Borkenau. Borkenau left Spain before, he was in Spain, but he left it before the May events, which according to Orwell and according to Pomage to Catalonia, and basically, although Orwell slightly rehashed the order of events, these May events, when the communists basically fought against their supposed allies on the left, that is POUM and anarchists, this was a major, major upheaval of Orwell's views. It was a major shock for him. And not in the last degree, it was because the propaganda, the communist propaganda at the time, was accusing these people who fought side by side with Orwell of being on Franco's side, on being on fascist side.
It strikes me, because we haven't got as much time as I would like, there is a parallel, because Orwell was very concerned about journalism and how Russia and Spain were reported and how the reports were censored by editors, and sometimes by editors who knew what he was saying were true but considered the truths inconvenient. And I think that's highly relevant to today, where we see the same type of, and the word is thought crime. They thought it was a thought crime to suggest the Soviet Union was less than perfect, even if they knew it wasn't. Also an example of doublethink, because they knew the Soviet Union wasn't perfect, but they pretended that it was. And it's these elements that really are still so prevalent today when, you know, we're looking at Ukraine, and there are people singing songs for Putin and saying things which are absolutely untrue. There are people whose answer to anything to do with Ukraine is Azov Brigade, who suggest I mean, could you get anything more Orwellian than suggesting that the Jewish president, democratically elected Jewish president of Ukraine, is a crypto-Nazi? I mean, you know, this, it would be difficult for one of Orwell's duck speakers to make this up. I mean, you know, it's as though the gramophone had got overtaken the duck.
Absolutely. No, the thing is, you see, I mentioned Borkinau because Borkinau said at one point that anybody who has a different opinion from the Orthodox Soviet communist is a Trotskyist. A Trotskyist in the Soviet speak is the man who should be killed. So any man who should be killed is a Trotskyist. Now, Borkinau knew what he was talking about because he was arrested himself by the NKVD when he was in Spain in February 1936. But Orwell mentioned that when he understood very well that he understood very well that this accusation of Trotskyism or of fascism was just a very convenient accusation. And when even today, when the Soviet propaganda talks about Ukraine, they're saying Ukrainian Nazis. All of them are Nazis. And we have a Russian representative in the United Nations, Vasily Nebenzia, rather awful type of person, who says that, yes, of course, it was unfortunate that several dozens of people were killed in one village during the wake, or because one of their villages had been killed. But then he says, look, they all were nationalists, they all were Nazis, so it was quite a legitimate thing to do. And the United Nations is keeping silent at this point. This is something that calls for Orwell, because Orwell has always understood, yes, there is a lot of evil in the world, but you, as somebody living in a free country, somebody who is at least nominally democratic, you can't say what Comrade Stalin does, or what Comrade Putin does, for that matter, is correct, because you know it isn't. And that is why, I mean, I had a very strong political impulse when I was writing this book, because I've been living in the West, in Britain, for over 30 years now. And for me, it was very clear, not only since the start of Putin's reign, but even under Yeltsin, when the first Chechen war started, it was absolutely clear that Russia is not going the way that the world was dreaming of when the Soviet Union collapsed, when the Berlin Wall collapsed, and when everybody hoped to see Russia becoming a normal country, or at least less brutal, less aggressive, less oppressive country. It was clear to many people, still for 30 years, and I was in journalism these 30 years, I could see that people preferred turning a blind eye to it. They prefer pretending that, well, every country has its own problems, and Russia is democratic, Russia is capitalist, and of course it's just growing, it's changing, and nothing dreadful is happening. And there were awful things happening, like the attack in the theater, the hostage taking in the theater, when the people who were supposed to save the hostages basically poisoned them with gas. As the hostage taking in Beslan, when children were held hostage, and then the Russian army just started the explosion, and lots of hostages died. I remember during the theater hostage taking, both Bush and Blair congratulated Putin on the wonderful handling of the hostage crisis, because that was the atmosphere all the 30 years that I've been
Could
living here
we walk it back one
till the
more? Because you're talking about, I mean, the habit of mind, it's not necessarily due to on ideology. It really is a totalitarian habit. But, you know, the original sin of Gorbachev, Mikhail Gorbachev, might have been when on Chernobyl he decided, nothing happening here, move on.
This is true, but Gorbachev, you see, Gorbachev was a much more complex figure than those who succeeded him. You see, he did, at least in theory, he did want Russia different. He knew, first of all, he knew that it would collapse economically if he did not change things. But he also hoped, although he didn't have enough courage, to really make the reforms, to really change, well, to ban the KGB. You know, he did not even do that.
One of the
But
things that I thought at the time, and I'd like to, because it is relevant, it's not just me ventilating my fevered opinions, but part of Gorbachev's failure was he thought that you could reform a society by decree. From the top, he had the old Soviet habit, and he thought all he had to do was to sign a decree, everyone be nice from tomorrow, and everyone would be nice while leaving all the apparatus of unniceness behind.
look, but this might be true, but still he opened up
No,
the
I'm
country.
speaking in his support. I mean, it was a valiant effort.
He opened it up. But to come back to Orwell, I think we should. It's just that the later in Orwell's life it went, the clearer he understood how dangerous this totalitarian thinking might be. And sort of, we've named just the three main influences, Lanzi and his early anti-Stalin stance, Mifanwy Westrope, who was so scared and so disappointed in what she saw and what she heard in the Soviet Union. Then, of course, the Spanish War, where he saw probably for the first time the power that propaganda based on lies has on people's opinions. That was then. Since then, as he did say himself, every line he wrote was for democratic socialism as he understood it, and against totalitarianism.
Does
Now,
that it just a thought that came up because you mentioned, and I hadn't realized this, that the Esperantist Lanzi actually wrote some very revelatory documents about the Soviet Union, its life, but ironically, he wrote them in the universal language and no one could understand them,
yes,
including Orwell. This is It's a tragedy in every way.
It is such a tragic paradox, you know, when somebody writes a universal language. And then if you had written them in French, you know, in France, there was, unlike Britain, I must say, at that point, late 20s, early 30s, in France, there were over half a dozen of people who already, people on the left, I mean, there were quite a few people on the left who understood the dangers of the Soviet system. And one of them was Lanzi's friend, also Esperantist, called Robert Guineuf, who published under the name of Yvonne. And this man, because he had worked, he'd lived 10 years in the Soviet Union. He worked there. He knew how the system is organized. He knew how workers lived. And what he wrote was later reviewed and very much taken on board by Marie-Louise Bernieri, who was a remarkable woman, unfortunately died, who died tragically young. She was, on the one hand, she was a daughter of Camilla Bernieri, who understood also the anarchists, who understood the dangers of the Soviet approach, and was killed, most likely that he was killed by the NKVD also. On the other hand, she was the wife of Bernard Richards, the man who we who did all these wonderful wonderful photographs of Orwell, which we have in, you know, in this book, George Orwell at Home, and there are plenty. He was also an anarchist. He was a friend of Emma Goldman, and he published published a newspaper about Spanish events. Orwell was friends with him. So Marie-Louise Bernieri wrote a book, Workers in the Soviet Union, where she based a lot of her research on Yvonne's data. So this is, of course, about the French situation then. Very briefly, how Orwell got his information later. He was friends with Gleb Struve, a Russian emigre, who provided some little detail, but which was fascinating for Orwell, about the disappearance of facts from Soviet history books. He also got some information from just ordinary people in Britain. There was a journalist called Frank Barber, who sent him a story, who on seeing Orwell's columns in Tribune, he sent him a story about their attempt, his newspaper in, now, where was
Leeds.
It? In Leeds. You're right. In
the Leeds Weekly Citizen.
Leeds Weekly Citizen wrote about Alexander Barmin, one of the early defectors from the Soviet Union. And readers in Britain and England, they couldn't believe that was true, that the man somehow ran away from the Soviet Union, from this paradise, and he wrote to Moscow. And in Moscow, they said, Alexander Barmin, this man never existed. And, you know, that also fed into Orwell's imagination. And when
he paired it, as I remember, with the British government was sponsoring celebrations of the foundation of the Red Army. And for all of his many faults, Trotsky was not insignificant in the foundation of that body. And
yes.
He completely disappeared. He was pushed off like Yezhov into the river. Yeah. From those, one of those photographs.
In the photographs, yes. That was, he followed all this little detail, and his article, The Freedom of the Press, which was meant as a preface to The Animal Farm, but later on he, you know, his artistic sense in a way, was more important for him than his political sense. He thought, probably, we don't know, of course, but he probably thought that Animal Farm stands on its own and he doesn't need to do this preface about the horrible role of the British intelligentsia, which did not want to see the horrors that
can we rehearse this one now as well, because I was, I think, round about the time that we met, the controversy re-erupted about Orwell's alleged snitch list. And I pointed out at the time that this was a recommendation for who would promulgate social democracy. And why would he suggest the KGB agents like Peter Smollett? And the idea that the British establishment nominated a known KGB agent to head the Ministry of Information dealing with Russia is... It's a mystery. It makes Anthony Blunt, and because what's he going to do? Censor the King's pictures, Anthony Blunt. But the idea that you appoint somebody like that to monitor communications between Russia and Britain is mind-boggling would be the word, except there's no minds involved, really.
he was also awarded an OBE.
So yes,
somebody must have promoted him, and all the years of the war.
The man, by the way. This is apropos of the fact that this is the guy who was putting in the word to stop the publication of Animal Farm on behalf of the British government.
And the man who is mentioned in Orwell's list, and the list he gave to his allies, he thought, to the people, that was the Labour government, and he was honestly thinking that he was trying to stop these people infiltrating and doing all these awful things. And it was, of course, Peter Smollett who tried to stop mentioning of Trotsky. This is absolutely obvious. And nobody who criticizes or even despises Orwell for this list acknowledges the fact that he was the man who saw through the people like Peter Smollett. There were others actually there as well. So
he went by his nose. I mean, the vitriol with which he pursued Connie Ziliakis, who I knew very vaguely as a as an early crypto. I knew a lot of these people, by the way.
Who
were in the Labour Party, yeah. and they were. I know people who were ordered to join the Labour Party by the Communist Party, and at the time I thought it wasn't that bad. They were nice people, and a bit like Orwell, because Orwell regarded himself as a Tory anarchist, didn't he? And he was
at an earlier stage, yes, he did.
But he was also quite how should we say, very wide definition liberal. I mean, he did alter the final text of Animal Farm, so he preferred to Stalin.
Yes,
who he thought showed courage over the siege of Stalingrad and the attack on Moscow. Now, you don't get much of that degree of open-mindedness on the other side very often.
Well, Orwell, A, was a romantic, B, he was a writer. So the way he wrote about things was very often colored by these perceptions. But his nose, as you said, was always, you know, in the right, his heart was in the right place, and his nose helped him to make judgments about the political situation at the time. And I'm sure that I was actually very interested not only in discovering these connections with Russia, but also reading about some remarkable people in British socialism. I didn't know them, unlike you, and also people who were acting in the 30s. They were really, some of them were remarkable people. I didn't know, for example, that Citrin, who Orwell did not like at all, that he, together with the man called Adler, in the trade union movement, that they sent a telegram to Stalin when the first Moscow trial happened, saying this is not the workers' justice, this is not how this should be. We can't believe that Lenin's comrades overnight became traitors. So I thought, I appreciated it is very complicated road that the British left went through, and their opinions were often different, but there were some people who were, how should I put it, they were worthy of respect, and it was very interesting for me as an outsider to get acquainted with them. We probably don't have much time left.
We don't really. I mean, I'm just throwing some more on both sides. There was a British trade union delegation to Russia in the 20s, which went to Georgia, whose revolution was put down by the Soviet Union around the same time. And it was a democratic socialist revolution as well. So that was put down. And I have several other books from British trade unionists who were in Russia for the revolution. And it's amazing after 100 years how prescient they all are. They all looked and they said, yes, but this, this and this. And they really, even at that time, had identified the seeds of totalitarianism that were building in there. But we are coming towards the end, as you pointed out. So unfortunately, 2 + 2 = 5. It does not apply to the time warp here. We have to finish. Please try and read the book. And Orwell, I think, is one of the towering geniuses of journalism. He is a very prickly character, bit of a snob. I don't think he ever went into a pub full of dockers and had a chat with them. But he's, in his way, he understood far more about it than, by the way, dockers means longshoremen. It doesn't mean medical practitioners, I should say. So this is Ian Williams from the Foreign Press Association with Masha Karp. We've had, I think, a vigorous run round the houses. I'm disappointed that none of you came in to ask questions, but then who needs you when we can ask our own questions? Thank you very much. And we know the answers as well.
Thank you very much, Ian. Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
Thank you all. And we'll see you again soon, because we have more stuff coming up, all good stuff. And if you have any suggestions for webinars and panels and events that the Foreign Press Association can host and deal with, then let us know, please. We've had a bit of a dearth due to illness and staff problems and the end of the world intervening, but we're back on track now. Please come along. Thank you very much again from the Foreign Press Association. Thank you very much again, Masha.
Thank you. Thank you.